everyone, welcome to the Verity Love Poetry Podcast. I'm Alice Allen. Every month we talk to a poet who's been published in the journal and we discuss their poem along with the work of a poet who they admire. Today I'm joined by Verity Love's managing editor Michelle Seminara, and together we'll be talking with guest poet P.S. Cottier. Hey guys, how are you going?
I'm, as you can probably hear from my voice, not quite 100%, but you know, I couldn't bear to let you down, so I dragged myself out of my sick bed.
Oh, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. How are you going, Michelle?
Alice, I'm good, thank you, Alice. Yes, quite healthy, which is a good thing.
That's good. So, Penelope, I had to read the first paragraph of your bio from your website because it's just so funny. You say, I am a poet who occasionally writes prose. I have worked as a lawyer, a university tutor, a union organiser and a tea lady. I wrote a PhD on animals in the works of Charles Dickens at the Australian National University. I give frequent readings of my work in Canberra and elsewhere and often dabble in the foul pit of literary competitions, sometimes with success. I have judged poetry competitions too, which probably puts me on a particularly interesting level of Dante's Inferno. So, I really love that. I'd like to start off actually by asking you about being a judge. Can you remember a reaction that you had to a particularly terrible poem? Have you ever gotten something out of the slush pile and thought, oh my God, I've got to throw this across the room?
The worst ones are not the ones I remember as the ones that let themselves down, that had a good idea or interesting images, but then had an awful cliche thrown in or something that really ruined what could have been a good poem. I tend to remember those ones that let themselves down more than ones that just were bad from the very beginning, because I find them more disappointing. And of course, if it's a literary competition, you don't give individual feedback, but so you have no way of saying to these people, this could be a much stronger poem if you played around with this image a bit and didn't say something like pitch black night or something. I'm forgetting which cliches particularly annoyed me, but that's what I find worse, is when something could have been good and just wasn't. But you don't have the opportunity of saying that. And at one literary competition, there was someone who had written what I would say was a bad poem who really wanted feedback. And I was very fortunate to have the thing of saying, sorry, it's against the rules to give feedback, because in all honesty, I couldn't find anything positive to say about their poems. So it does happen you get one that's really bad. This was one where there was a live presentation, so you actually met people who'd entered.
That's tough. That would have been really tough. But you're protected in that way.
It's tougher to be the person whose poem was rejected than the judge anyway. But it's not an easy thing in some ways, in that you... It depends whether you want to be nice to someone. It would be great for someone who was really horrible, but I don't want someone off writing poetry for the rest of their lives because of one poor entry. Because I'm sure if we look back, everyone wrote some bad poetry when they were in their teens or earlier.
Oh, yeah.
With throbbing hearts or loins, if we go back far enough, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm still writing quite bad poetry now, you know, so I think we can all use a experienced eye to look over it if we can get it. But as you say, sometimes feedback's a double-edged sword as well.
Mm. And most competitions don't allow for any feedback. It's just you won or you're highly commended or nothing. It just, you don't know. You don't. It can be an experience you don't learn from because you have no idea what happened. Yeah.
That's true. Although sometimes when I've had poems rejected, I've preferred that just a no, because I've had a few rejections with a bit of snarky feedback and I've thought, no will do, that's enough.
Yes. The thing I hate most when it's for a journal or an anthology is where you get, I really loved your poem, but it just missed the final cut. I'd rather just get a no. I don't want kind words. I just want publication or a no. So
yes, I think I feel the same, yeah.
The best thing I have is a prose one where they said, this is like a combination of Jane Austen and who was the other person? And Le Carre, but it doesn't quite meet our needs.
Ah, interesting.
If you're comparable with those two, I think you're doing pretty well. I think that was an exaggeration, but it was just those two things and then the cliche didn't quite meet our needs. But sometime, yeah. And I think it's wrong because I can't think of anyone further from what I write than Jane Austen.
I wouldn't have said Austen reading your work, Penelope. I definitely wouldn't. That wouldn't have been the first.
No.
Comparison.
So perhaps they were drunk or just trying to be kind.
Maybe. there's a fantastic interview with you in Verity Love, which I will make sure that we link to. And in that interview you say, I hate the fact there is a hierarchy of publication in poetry. But that was in 2012. Would you still say that the hierarchy that you were talking about then is in place now?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And it's how you negotiate that. It's how you see poetry, whether you just want people to read your poems. For instance, I tend to publish an original poem every Tuesday on my blog, which may be a haiku or it may be something longer. Not that I'm saying that haiku is an inferior form or anything like that. Which is, in a way, just giving it for free to whoever might like to read my blog. But certainly there is a hierarchy of journals. There's a hierarchy of publishers. There's a hierarchy of poets, unfortunately. And some people seem to have no problem with that, whereas I can honestly say that if people are reading my poetry, I'm happy. And that's, I don't really care about the numbers so much or the prestige of where they're published. It's more journals I find interesting and so on. I will still try and submit to those. But if it's something I want to get out there quickly, I would prefer to put a poem on my blog. For instance, the poem I wrote recently about the greyhound racing ban in New South Wales and the ACT, which I was able to write something quickly and put it up because that's something I felt quite deeply about at the time.
Yeah, I suppose that's a great thing about blogging is that you can write something that's quite topical and you don't have to wait.
Well, you don't have to have it approved by an editor. The result of this is there are some poetry blogs out there which I don't think the poetry itself is very good, but I accept mine from that judgment. The poems I put on my blog are, I think, of the same standard as ones I send to journals such as Cordite or Mountain or whatever. Not always, and that's good too. You can play around with things and even get some feedback on the blog sometimes. Of course, if it's out there, it's been published in terms of most journals, but then you have to just write something else.
Yeah, and I really appreciate seeing poems that are not perfect put out on things like blogs. That helps me a lot to see that there is variation, even with people who I would consider quite accomplished. It's good to see that not every single poem works, just reminds you that it's always a process of refining.
I was just going to follow through with the 365 plus one or 366, the project that's been on where people are writing a poem a day. That I did for 1 month in June, and that's certainly because of, in a way, the demand to produce something every day. I put poems on that which would have benefited from more work, but it was still a good thing to let loose a little bit and put something out every day, I think.
Yeah, it's a great. I also did the 365 plus one blog, and yeah, it's wonderful to push you along and produce something, and also to get used to, I think, putting work out there that isn't finished. You know, there's something about that. We want to present our best side, I suppose, but there's probably quite a good side to just putting stuff out there and a draft, essentially, and letting people see that. I remember reading about a journal in the US, I can't remember what it's called now, but that was their whole thing. They publish the final poem, but they then also publish drafts, whether it's screenshots of handwritten drafts or, you know, computerized drafts of how the poet got to that final draft. And it's a really fascinating journal, actually. I think a lot of people would find it really helpful.
Yeah, and that perhaps it's more a notion of improvising than a printed piece of music. That might also be a useful metaphor for the process.
Ah, yes, yeah, that's a nice way of thinking of it.
Penelope, you mentioned Plumwood Mountain as a place that you send poetry to sometimes. Would you be able to talk us through the role of animals and the natural world in your poetry, so the theme of eco-poetics?
Starting on a slightly more personal note, when I look back, I can remember I became a vegetarian when I was 11, and that's going back a fair way. Being vegetarian in those days was, I think, more of a radical step than it is these days, and vegetarians got a lot of flack in the way that vegans do today. It just came about thinking about my own pet dog, and how I was feeding this dog meat made from another animal. And although I wouldn't impose vegetarianism on a dog, it just really struck me how weird it was that we classify some animals as pets and some as not. I haven't been vegetarian all that time. I've gone on and off, but this time's lasted a very long time. In my poetry, I hadn't really thought of this before, so much before that interview that was in Verity Lyre. It's just, to me, a way I express myself through animals. It just seems to happen. I like to look specifically at various animals, and it just sort of powers my poetry. It's not that I sit back and think that this of a new metaphor through an animal. It's just always there. It's almost part of a language I have, I think. So I really can't go that much further with that, in that perhaps I've always felt that we're so closely related to animals, and in a way that's helped me with the move to writing more, how can I put it, more politically informed poetry around the issue of animals, which eco-poetry, that term's been around, I was reading since the 1980s, but certainly I didn't hear it until probably the 1990s, even the late 1990s. But I think that with our greater knowledge of climate change and things, where we're actually seeing a loss of animals already to the effects of climate change, it's in a way the political issue that should inform a lot of poetry, whether that's just admiring the diversity of animals and the environment we have now, or lamenting its loss, or more political poetry that's directly concerned with climate change. So in a way, those issues, in a way, I think it's how we always have what we're interested in there from the very beginning in us, but it's continually circling back to early concerns. So I'm finding more and more in my poetry that's happening.
That's so interesting, Penelope. I was reading that Verity Lyre interview again as well, and you mentioned something about the recognition of natural beauty in the environment, your recognition, and you linked that to your ability to write, and also sort of correlated that to your move to Canberra and sort of becoming more aware of your natural environment. I found that really fascinating that you linked your recognition of sort of natural beauty with your ability to write. And I was wondering if you could sort of expand upon that a little more.
Yes, and there's a few aspects to that. There's one sort of poetry which I do not like, which is purely looking at the natural environment as something external, as something which just exists for us to marvel at and which is totally separate from us. And there's another sort of thing where the separation between us and the environment isn't so great, where we are embedded in that environment. I think there's a place for poetry that does just look at beauty, but I think that can easily fall into a sort of laziness, and this I call misty cow poetry, where it's always in a rural environment and someone's just looking out at, say, an agricultural landscape, and it has no awareness of history or previous settlement of that land or anything like that. It's just looking at the cow's breath in the mist type thing. But to totally contradict that, moving to Canberra, I have definitely become more aware of the natural environment than I was in Melbourne, which is where I grew up. I was born in England but moved to Melbourne when I was a baby. I had a totally urban lifestyle, I think, certainly my last 10 years in Melbourne, and was virtually blind to notions of nature. Or to come to Canberra and to sit in what's called the inner city of Canberra and to have cockatoos in a tree really nearby, you'd have to be deliberately ignoring that presence, whereas in Melbourne, in the inner areas, it's a lot easier to forget about that aspect of things. And I don't by any means mean to insult people who are in inner Melbourne. I'm sure many of them have a far greater awareness of the environment than I did. But Canberra does offer the opportunity to go for a bushwalk within 5 minutes of where I'm sitting in, again, what's seen as the inner suburbs of Canberra. It's also, I think, even the cold here. I'm not saying Melbourne's not cold, of course, but the cold here is something that I'd never experienced before. And it's very hard to ignore your body actually experiencing cold, perhaps in a way that we don't in other parts of Australia. But in terms of poetry, it's how we reflect the natural environment and what that word natural even means, given that we're entering a time where our effects are shaping nature in a way that hasn't happened before. Our, of course, meaning advanced industrial society and the emissions we cause. And it means something else now to talk of nature than it did even 30 years ago, before we really knew of those effects, or the average person knew of those effects.
Yeah, this probably leads us fairly naturally into your poem published in Plumwood Mountain. Reading the Frog Economy. Would you like to read that one for us now, and then maybe we can chat about it?
No worries. I've got them all open on my computer. God, I'm organised. Okay. So this was in Plumwood Mountain, and it's Reading the Frog Economy, looking back to Melbourne, actually. Reading the Frog Economy. So if frogs were currency, I grew up in a time of wealth. We'd pour dozens of lively tatties into buckets, little ones like commas in the rich brown pages of the ponds, betwixt us sprouting legs like exclamation marks, and the fat copper adults. They weren't like rare coins back then when I was a lass. They were just as common as 2 cent pieces, nursery rhyme familiars. Every suburban bog housed their evening puck-pucks of attraction, their sudden bursts of swim. Ah, but since then, since that once upon a time, it's been a real bear market for the frog economy. We've cleansed the ponds of amphibious poetry. Soft bodies, splayed feet are not a good bet on the futures exchange. I'd invest in bottled pure water if I were you. Read the labels, guaranteed to contain no frog. Music or body or magical transformation or splash or the foaming floating islands of egg. In my memory, I flick every rock and find a frog deposit. We withdraw them with no worry, take them home in triumphant ice cream containers, a whole Europe of minor princes carried by a court of pesky kids. Now a child blessed with luck might be shown a frog as if it were formed from a weak and discoloured gold, about to melt away, first legs, then body. See that, children? That's a frog. No kissing, please.
Oh, that's fabulous. I love the way you read it as well, Penelope.
Thanks. I'm doing a few more readings, it seems, at the moment, and enjoying them more each time I do it. I try very much in that one to have economics, basically capitalism entering into what seems to be the loss of frogs, which May or may not be directly related to climate change. I don't know enough about that. I'm hoping to actually produce a series of linked poems about climate change over starting early next year, but we'll see.
Yeah, the first time I read this in Plumwood Mountain, I have to admit my reaction was anger more than anything, because you reminded me that in my own childhood I had done similar things that happened in the first stanza, collecting frogs, and yeah, just realizing that that was probably not so much an option anymore. But along with, I feel that there's rage in that poem, but I also feel that there is humor and a lightness. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of humor in your poetry and how that plays against the idea that poetry requires tragedy and sadness to be good.
I was just thinking about this the other day in rereading some Shakespeare, how there's still, I think, a greater weight given to, and I'm not comparing myself with Shakespeare, but a greater weight given to the tragedies than to the comedies. And personally, I prefer the comedies. A Midsummer Night's Dream is about my favourite Shakespeare, which also has some very grim things in it about mistaken identity and so on. Excuse me, I'm going to have to re-top my vodka if this is continuing. But humour, of course, can be a way of pushing away anger. It can also engage just as much with any issue as that sort of unthought sentimentality that mars a lot of poetry. What I was talking about just describing environment with me as the ultra-sensitive person looking at the environment, I think a bit of humour can undercut that. And that's what I was trying to do in that poem. Humour, to me, though, comes quite naturally. It's the way I look at things. I don't think that humour, so long as it's not a cruel humour, or if it is a cruel humour, that it's directed only at the right targets, I don't think that it's less able to reveal things than anger or a sort of sentimental romantic attitude. That's what really gets me in a lot of poetry, is that just the individual as almost the voice of God, and the voice of God is very much a serious male voice, male, whether it's a man or a woman speaking. A masculine voice perhaps is the better term.
Yeah, I don't think I'm never going to forget that term, misty cow poems, from now on. That's so God, I've written a lot of those. I've written so many misty cow poems. That's so useful.
There's nothing wrong with looking at nature and trying to describe it. It's just, as I was saying, it can't be an innocent look anymore. You can try and be innocent. I wrote a poem called Knowledge Stole the Weather, which is about how our knowledge of climate change stops that easy chat at the bus stop being so free, in a way, where you say, oh, it's a hot one today, or and you think, oh, my God, emissions, and it's always there in the back of your head. So even in the every day it enters into it. Perhaps it doesn't, but there's that very active pushing away that some people do, that climate change isn't real, that it's not happening, which I think is a refusal to admit a connection with nature in a strange way. Like we are affecting nature, but it's a desire to pull back from any responsibility or embeddedness in what we call nature.
It really reminds me, Penelope, of something that Philip Hall said on our very first poetry podcast, and he was talking also about eco-poetry, and he said that the idea that of wilderness, you know, an untouched nature, untouched by man, is very much a colonial concept, because for Indigenous people, for example, they wouldn't consider that they weren't enmeshed and embedded and part of nature. And so there is no such thing as wilderness, you know, nature untouched by people and vice versa. And I had never thought about it like that, but what you're saying is kind of a similar thing, but coming from a different different aspect, I suppose.
Well, even if you think Antarctica is being affected by climate change. There really is no wilderness. That is true. And certainly to speak of wilderness in Australia is to deny the length and breadth, I would say, in a way, of Indigenous effect on the land and embeddedness in that land.
Earlier, Penelope, you mentioned this idea of the voice of God, this kind of masculine voice, and brings us to the poem that you brought to talk to us about today by Denise Levertov. It's called To Live in the Mercy of God. Can you tell us when you came across this poem and what you thought when you first read it?
Quite recently. I was just flicking through. I think it's the Poetry Foundation, the American. It's a fantastic resource where they have a lot of poems up, and you can go there for free and look them up. And it was just I've been trying to write about notions of God. And I found this woman's poem. I didn't know much about her except that she'd been very active in the peace movement in the United States. And it was just a poem that, you know, sometimes you read one and you just know you're going to go back to it a lot of times. And I love the way she seems to be stretching to find what she's trying to say in the poem. And, of course, people can't see this unless they go to the Poetry Foundation and look up the poem. But there's no one form in which the words are put down. It's trying different things in every stanza. To Live in the Mercy of God by Denise Levertov. To lie back under the tallest, oldest trees, how far the stems rise before ribs of shelter open, to live in the mercy of God. The complete sentence, too adequate, has no give, or not comfort. Stones, elbows of stony wood beneath lenient moss bed, and awe suddenly passing beyond itself, becomes a form of comfort, becomes the steady air you glide on, arms stretched like the wings of flying foxes. To hear the multiple silence of trees, the rainy forest depths of their listening, to float upheld as salt water would hold you once you dared, to live in the mercy of God, to feel vibrate the enraptured waterfall flinging itself unabating down and down to clenched fists of rock, swiftness of plunge, hour after year after century, oh or ah, uninterrupted, voice many-stranded, to breathe spray, the smoke of it, arcs of steel-white foam, glissades of fugitive jade, barely perceptible, such passion, rage or joy. Thus not mild, not temperate, God's love for the world. Vast flood of mercy flung on resistance.
Pretty fantastic summing up of humanity there in the last three lines. Vast flood of mercy flung on resistance. It's an incredible poem, but it's pretty mystifying. I think I need a hand to kind of get into it. What was your reaction to it, Michelle? What did you think when you first read it?
I was really struck by the natural imagery, and I thought a lot of it was, very sort of imaginative. Like I loved the stony wood beneath lenient moss bed. I loved that lenient moss bed. And just a few other images really got me, and actually it reminded me a little bit of your poetry, Penelope, just in terms of the natural world coming in and that sort of thing. I was thinking, okay, I can see why this would really appeal to Penelope as well.
It's also for me, as someone who's been most of their life an atheist, but not for the last 5 or so years, it just reminds me of my thought that there is something beyond the merely mundane and trying to describe that. I think in public discourse, a sort of lazy atheism is the default at the moment. I'm not saying all atheism is lazy, but there is a sort of just unless you can explain things in purely scientific terms, it doesn't exist. I have a great respect for scientific method and so on, but I don't like science being elevated to a position of, what would you say?
Well, it's like a godlike position in a way. It's sort of like, it's like you have to take, if you're going to take God out of that omnipotent position, then science has to be put there to replace where God was.
And that becomes silly because science is a method and it can't explain everything. And it's almost like this poem is finding different ways of describing a feeling of awe and throwing it before us. And the form, I think, is quite lovely, the way she keeps trying different things. And very much there is a notion of the natural world as something to look to for a notion of God, but it's very much about the thought of that notion. It's not a simple look at this and feel God. It's about how God is embedded in things. So I found that quite remarkable. I think it's a very late poem for the artist, for the poet. I'm not sure what her date of death was, but and I also like the fact that she's perhaps best known as a protest poet or something, and that that is very much tied to her religious belief through reading about her life and so on. But I just think it's great and very brave poem. The different line length, the trying to deal with such a fundamental. That's a bad word. I don't like the word fundamental. To deal with such an important question of how God enters into us and into the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciated the fact that she sees in the small things, you know, as you say, it's like the sacred is embedded in those small things, and also within the poet herself, I suppose, and therefore in that sense, everything's connected. It's in some sense, you might say that writing about God is a sort of a traditional, old-fashioned sort of endeavor. But actually, this way of doing it is, it's quite different and quite feminine, I think, as well.
That's interesting. I don't think God certainly is given a sex in the poem. I'm just looking through. I don't see that, but it's a stranded voice that all genders will be included in that notion of God. And it's also about notions of awe and omnipotence falling to a notion of a lot of different voices and like voice many stranded, to breathe spray, the smoke of it, like it's different elements being merged, which I found very effective.
Yeah, I'm starting to appreciate the shape of it a lot more now, just the way it's trying to apprehend this idea through the different forms and these different attempts in every stanza. So I'm liking it more.
Good. my job here is done.
Excellent. Shall we move on now to your poem in Verity La, All the Blonde Jesuses? I love this one because it reminds me of two versions of Jesus that I've heard about in my life. So my year 11 Homer and the Bible teacher told us that Jesus apparently looked just like Danny DeVito, which we all thought was hilarious. And so I've thought about that since then, as the, you know, that's the truth, Danny DeVito, that's the historical truth of Jesus's appearance. And then my favorite podcaster, one of my favorites, Dan Savage, talks about, he's a lapsed Catholic, and he talks about how hot the snaky-hipped Jesus of the Catholic Church is, kind of up there on the cross with like the little towel kind of just covering him.
Oh, that's true. I've never let myself think that.
I know. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. So this poem reminded me of that.
The thing you were saying about Jesus being like Danny DeVito, there's a great poem by John Fulcher called oh, I can't remember its name, but it's about how Josephus describes Jesus, and it's as a small, almost hunchback, dark man.
I think I know that one, yeah.
I can't remember the name at the moment, but it's certainly more the Danny DeVito than the Snake Hip. Snake Hip is, Jesus is a great name for a poem, by the way. This mine is based on an Anglican Jesus. In the book, this was published in a collection of poems called Triptych Poets by Blemish Books, which had three poets doing 30 pages or so of poetry. And it had a note that this was a Jesus as seen in some of the stained glass windows in St. John's Anglican Church, Reed, ACT. This is one of the oldest surviving buildings in Canberra. I'd like to say there's no correct way to represent Jesus. Like, obviously, he would have been dark-haired and so on, but I've seen Indigenous depictions of Jesus where he's, you know, more dark-skinned and dark-haired. Not that that's the definition of Indigenous, but there's no one way to represent. But this is about Jesuses who look like David Gower in his prime when he was playing cricket for England. Or the blonde Jesuses. You see them wriggle free of windows, lithe as silverfish, but golden-haired. These Jesuses, blonde sons of blonde Marys, head out the door to play cricket with leather and willow in sudden whites. St. Dorothy joins in, and it's all fruit and flowers and UK May, as Jesuses bloom like jonquils on the soft field. Sometimes a Jesus will stop for a while, and an almost frown appears. He recalls another day when he was darker skinned, darker haired, and his reaching hands caught iron, not the ball flicked to slip like an idea. Oranges smile like cut suns. The stumped Jesus reconciles himself to this easier gig amongst teammates all as blonde and quick as wit itself. He scampers between wickets, wood kinder than when he cried and slumped and died before the dark cave and its inconstant rock. So, in a way, it starts with how this is perhaps a misrepresentation of Jesus, but works towards that it doesn't really matter whether he's shown as blonde or as dark-haired.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think what I'm getting from it now, maybe the third or fourth reading, is you're revealing how deeply sinister the crucifixion is. And I think this is something that really shocks me anytime I go into a church or I see an image of the crucifixion, is it is just so violent. I mean, that line, hands caught iron, or when he cried and slumped and died before the dark cave. Like, it's such a dark story.
Well, it's a political murder. It's a political execution. Yeah. Tends to be public and as unpleasant as possible. So, yes, it is horrible. The ones I'm talking about in general, it's his life, talking to people and things like that. In this particular church, I don't remember if there is a picture of the actual crucifixion in the Anglican church I'm talking about. I'd have to go back and look. It's more his life with miracles and so on. But, yes, certainly the crucifixion was as public and as unpleasant a death as you could produce at the time.
Mm. And you love writing about sport as well, don't you, Penelope? You've written a fair few sporting poems, which I love.
I must say one of my happiest days this year, and this shows how desperate in a way we are in Canberra, like coming from Melbourne, I found the image of AFL is overwhelming in Melbourne. It's, again, to use a Jesus metaphor, looking at Rio, the images we've had with the big Jesus sort of holding his hands up. You go to Melbourne, there's always a footballer in there,
yeah,
sort of like represented in some way. Coming to Canberra, of course, it's not such an AFL town. But we now have the Greater Western Sydney Giants play a few games per year at Manuka Oval. And going to see that was one of the happiest days of my life this year, just not because they beat Richmond by like 5 billion goals, but just it's so harmless. It's just sitting watching these young men run around kicking, and soon there'll be the National Women's League, of course, as well. But it just, it makes me so happy, the stupid theme songs. I mean, just in a way it's so simple, but we have this manic ball which is specifically designed so you don't know which way it's going to wobble. It's not as logical as soccer or what most of the world calls football. And it just in a way makes me happier than anything else, sitting and watching AFL. So in a way that I love to talk about sport because I love sport, but I also like thinking about sport and don't like the sort of the way it slides into a sort of matey discussion. I particularly don't like the betting on sport, which has become such a wide phenomenon that we still have it during live games and so on. I think that detracts from the love of just watching these people, or of playing it yourself, of course, even better still.
Oh, I love that confluence of sport and poetry. I don't think it happens often enough, you know. It's a great sort of subject to mine. But I was saying when we were talking about reading this poem of yours in Verity La, oh, it could be a great springboard for a talk about speculative poetry. And you're like, Michelle, that's not a speculative poem. And I was thinking,
about that.
I have no, and I find it such a slippery little, I suppose, title or subject, speculative. And I read in your, I think it was the introduction to Stars Like Sand, which you co-edited, that you define speculative as the area in which we attempt to write what we can't possibly know. And I think that's a fabulous definition, but I'm still really vague about it, and I find it embarrassingly difficult when I read a poem to really decide is it speculative or not. And I'm wondering if you can just educate me.
Instant reaction to you that the Jesus one is not speculative. We very much didn't include poems that were religious in the definition of speculative. Probably just not wanting to insult people, or that's a different realm of thought. It's certainly an area which has some element of a world or of discussion that is not. But that is different in some way from how we usually see the world. So, for example, classic things are science fiction, fantasy, horror, if it's of a supernatural type horror, the classic ones, but you could include surrealism. Some people include pure science poetry in their definition of speculative poetry. But, so just... things being in at least one way different from how most people, or how the world is seen. So science fiction is the obvious one, I suppose, where so in the anthology itself, the Stars Like Sand, the poems range from surrealism to space travel to witches and so on. And I must say at the moment I'm just proofing a little book of poems called Quick Bright Things, Poems of Fantasy and Myth, which is has a poem about fairies playing cricket. You'd like that one. Like it's the rules of cricket rewritten for the fairy world, which brings together sport and fantasy. So I'd be very interested to see how that goes. It's a pocketbook. But, speculative has a general meaning, I suppose, and it's using it in a slightly different way when we talk about speculative poetry or speculative fiction.
So it sounds like it's a fairly expansive word, really. There are some rules, but they're flexible rules.
Absolutely. The anthology itself, in one review, thought we went too far with what we included as speculative. They preferred things that were more like traditional science fiction in that definition. Others didn't. They liked the broad approach we took. But certainly there is, again, getting back to what sort of poetry you generally see published. Often there is a bit of a suspicion of anything. For instance, something set in the future. I would be very surprised if a major poetry competition has been won by a poem set in the future. I may be wrong on that. But, or with obvious fantasy elements.
Yes. Is there a bit of snobbery around that, Penelope? Like, you know, if is there a, is it to consider like a genre of poetry rather than a sort of literary poetry? Is there a divide?
I would say there is. Certainly, most of my speculative poetry gets published in the United States in journals that specialise in that sort of thing. Not all of it. I had one about ghosts in the Australian Poetry Journal quite recently. Mm. And I love that, sneaking speculative things into mainstream journals and so on. But there's a whole lot of journals in the United States that specialise in that sort of thing, and they may even be more. My favourite I ever got, in a way, was something that was doing cowboy Western science fiction. I've forgotten the name. But it was like I wrote one about being in a bar on a planet somewhere, that sort of thing. That was great fun. But I also like the more subtle stuff where it's just a step, if you like, to the left of what's seen as normal. My very favourite. But I do think there is a snobbery against anything but this sometimes rather tedious realism. And again, like, what does that mean? Does it mean you don't look at ideas too much? And speculative, of course, is where it's just ideas placed upon a notion of what's real. So it may be that it's set a bit in the future, or it may be that it's expanded to include fantasy elements. And it's a bit strange if you can't do that, I think. But certainly if I was advising someone, I'd say if you've written a science fiction poem, don't bother sending it in for a competition, unless it's a science fiction competition. Because that's also in fiction too. A lot of people don't take horror or science fiction novels as seriously as they should be taken. And they are often the ones who are a little bit ahead on things like, well, again, climate change. There's a whole lot of books that have been written in that area. And
I wanted to finish off by asking, what's making you feel enthusiastic about sitting down to write or read poetry at the moment?
Oh, that's a good question. Often it's things like discovering Levitov, not that she's an unknown poet, but I came across her quite recently. I'm finding poems that are based around ecological concerns, trying to write those without being too hectoring, quite interesting. And it's just when I, basically things like puns, what drives a particular poem, when I start it and it just goes off almost like it's being dictated by someone else, and it's funny and has puns in it, and I suppose to sound arrogant, where it has very much my own voice, and I know perhaps this one little thing no one else could quite have done in the same way. That's what motivates me. Reading collections by poets I like is good, and going back, reading more Byron and stuff, I really enjoy.
Yeah, you mentioned Byron's Darkness as a potential poem that you might read today. And you also mentioned Samuel Weigand Watson. If there are people listening who haven't read any of his work, where should we start with Samuel Weigand Watson?
His book, Smoke Encrypted Whispers, I believe it is. I'd have to check that. But when I read that, I knew it was something very different, yeah. And he does a lot of readings here and there, so if you get the chance to go and see him read, he's a great performer of his poems, apart from anything else. That's one thing I'm trying to improve, and I should be going to, well, tomorrow is a, I'm hoping to go to something on performance poetry soon, but I'm pushing myself to do more readings and so on, which is another way of seeing the poetry in a different way. My ideal time is just shut in a room writing all on my own, which is great, but I also want to do a little bit more reading in public, and that's been happening recently, so that's good.
Well, we might let you sign off and recover now, Penelope, but thank you so much for your time tonight, and thank you, Michelle.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Alice.
Thanks for listening, everyone. You can find more episodes at veritylar.com.